From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Today, early voting began in Texas. Now, the largest county in Texas is bigger than the state of Connecticut. But last night, a court sided with the state's Republican governor, Greg Abbott, and ruled the state is allowed to restrict ballot drop boxes to one per county, as the governor mandated. And in California, Republicans are defending placing what the state is calling illegal ballot boxes in three counties. They say they'll remove the label official. The state wants them to remove the boxes, period. This is all happening as the president is baselessly accusing Democrats of trying to undermine the election's integrity.
Meanwhile, in Georgia, voters turned out in record numbers for the first day of early voting, but some faced hours in long lines at the polls and technical issues in a state that has been plagued by barriers to voting, particularly for Black residents. Joining us now is Stephen Fowler of Georgia Public Broadcasting. Welcome, Stephen.
Always a pleasure.
Yes, so many people in Georgia will actually remember the long delays in voting during the primary election back in June. How long were people waiting this time around, and what concerns does this raise?
Well, that's right, Tanya. In the June primary, you had reports of people waiting 5, 6, 7, 8 hours on election day. The last vote wasn't actually cast until the next morning. And this time, the first day of in-person early voting in Georgia, you had people waiting as long as 11 or 12 hours in line in some of these Metro Atlanta early voting locations. And now early voting, there are fewer locations spread throughout these counties, and more people are usually interested on the first day. And also, it was a state holiday, so many people had the day off. So that's where you're seeing some of these lines forming, and actually in all corners of the state, not just in metro counties. You had rural counties, too, that had hundreds of voters lining up throughout the day.
Okay, so are election officials worried, though, that these delays will continue?
Well, I heard from Fulton County Election Director Rick Barron. Fulton is where the city of Atlanta is, and he said they've been planning for lines. They have been planning for people to show up. They've been planning for more people to be interested in this election because Georgia has both U.S. Senate seats on the ballot and is a battleground for the White House. But they do anticipate lines should go down as the days progress through early voting and then pick back up again right at the end before people last minute get in there. But we have seen a history of non-white voters, especially in the Metro Atlanta area, often end up bearing the brunt of these longer wait times.
Mm-hmm. At the State Farm Arena in Atlanta, Georgia's largest early voting site, there were also some issues with the technology, the relatively new voting machines. Similar problems plagued the June primary. What have you heard about those?
Right. So at State Farm Arena, there are 60 check-in computers and 300 voting machines for people. It's Georgia's largest ever site, as you said. And for about an hour, those check-in computers didn't work. Officials reset those and moved people quickly through the line. Elsewhere, there have been problems with poll workers getting things set up with the check-in computers or using the touchscreen voting machines that some critics say add unnecessary time and stress to the voting process.
This is incredible turnout. I mean, of course, we'll have to see what happens over the next few weeks. But do you have any sense of whether this surge in voting might actually help a certain party or candidate?
That's right, Tanya. The turnout is incredible. We also are seeing a record number of Georgians requesting and returning absentee ballots. As of this morning, more than 600,000 votes have already been cast here in Georgia. Oh, wow. And election watchers say that this surge is maybe going to help Democrats have a competitive edge in Georgia, where it's going to be a razor-thin margin. According to some election data, about a quarter of the votes that have been cast already are people who didn't participate in the 2016 special election. So it's really going to come down to turnout. I know it's cliche, but there's just an unprecedented amount of energy here in Georgia, and we're going to see starting November 3rd when the results come in what that actually is going to look like.
You've been covering politics and voting for quite a while. What are you looking forward to as voting continues?
Well, the things I'm going to look at are the turnout for numbers in Atlanta suburbs. There's two competitive U.S. House races there full of voters that have kind of turned away from the Republican Party. And so those will be the deciding factors for both House races and both U.S. Senate seats. And so we're going to see where people show up. And if those people show up in those suburbs, it'll most likely be Democrats. And that could end up being a game changer for Georgia.
That's Stephen Fowler, reporter with Georgia Public Broadcasting. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Well, across the U.S., new cases of COVID-19 are up 19% from just 2 weeks ago. Public health experts are concerned. They're watching that second wave of virus crest in Europe. Meanwhile, President Trump is now back on the campaign trail at a rally in Florida last night, saying he has beaten the coronavirus.
I went through it. Now they say I'm immune. I feel so powerful. I'll walk into that audience. I'll walk in there. I'll kiss everyone in that audience. I'll kiss the guys and the beautiful women and everybody. I'll just give you a big fat kiss.
Big fat kiss. Dr. Jennifer Nuzzo is lead epidemiologist for the Johns Hopkins COVID-19 Testing Insights Initiative. And Dr. Nuzzo, a couple questions here. It's the president's doctor, Sean Conley, who says the president has tested negative for the coronavirus. But help us understand, can you test negative right after being sick as he was and still be shedding virus and infecting people?
Yeah, so I think what that test was really aimed at was trying to establish whether the president was going to be contagious. But what he was talking about was whether he's immune. And we really don't know much about whether you are immune after becoming infected. In fact, there was just a report yesterday of somebody who was infected twice and the second infection was worse than the first. And so that's really something that we have to worry about. So I don't think anybody who hears the president should at all be reassured that just because they had it once means that they can't have it again or that they can't give it to somebody. And that, I think, is a really worrisome assertion.
Right. This was a 25-year-old in Nevada who got it twice. And there are cases elsewhere outside this country of people who seem to have gotten it twice. I mean, if all the testing is to be believed. And so maybe you can test negative, maybe even have antibodies, meaning that you fought off COVID-19. And so you're saying this might mean that you may not be completely immune. You might be, be able to catch it down the road.
Yeah, I mean, we think that there's probably going to be some level of immunity, but that perhaps the immunity can wane with some time. And we're still very much learning. We don't know if this report is sort of a one-time occurrence in a small number of cases or if it's something that others can expect. But I don't think anybody should take away that, you know, just because they've had it before, if they know someone who's had it before, that that means that they are completely safe. That would be quite a dangerous conclusion.
Well, I'm sure you're watching these clusters that are coming, Wisconsin, serious outbreaks, the University of Alabama, for instance. What do you think? Is this just we didn't really snuff out the first wave, or is this the beginning of a second wave?
Yeah, so we are, you know, first of all, epidemiologists don't usually talk about waves as data are rolling in. But reason to think that we are still on the first wave is that we never really went down to baseline in the same way that maybe some other countries did. What we've seen is that we've had a few dips here and there, but the dips, quickly rose again. And I think what is more likely happening is we're seeing the effects of, case numbers rise and people get concerned and then new restrictions are put in place. But then after some time, people begin to kind of relax those restrictions and the case numbers come right back.
Well, we're looking at New York City. The daily cases there just hit 500 again. That's the first time since June. Some of the outbreaks there have to do with the ultra-Orthodox Jewish community in Brooklyn, for instance, refusing restrictions. But are you also thinking about, you know, fall, cooler months, people indoors with air trapped there?
I think most epidemiologists are really worried about the fall. One, because of that, just that, the weather. Our ability to socialize is made a little bit easier if we can keep it outside. And as the weather gets cooler, it obviously becomes a lot harder to do that. But we're also worried about the fact that people are tired and they really just want to be around loved ones and friends. And so it really becomes hard to adhere to those public health messages to kind of keep your distance and limit your contacts. And so those two things put together, fewer outdoor options and people really naturally wanting to get together, unfortunately creates a situation where we could see a steep rise in cases.
Well, the other day, Dr. Birx of the task force said that even families and people who live together who might have thought of themselves as a pod, when you are in homes and in places together, you should still wear a mask. Do you agree?
That's true. I mean, I think the challenge with the pod is that not everybody has the exact same exposure. Some folks go to work. Some folks do have some social interactions outside of the pod. And so that always raises the possibility that somebody could have become infected when they were, you know, doing something else. And One way to reduce the likelihood of spreading it to others is to keep your distance and wear a mask and do all those measures that we always talk about. These measures are, we apply them in a layered effect, and they serve to reduce your risk. And, I think there's some danger in just assuming that, you're completely safe just because it's your family.
Yeah. And by the way, just briefly, we know Johnson & Johnson just announced they're hitting pause on one of their vaccine trials, but that could mean the system's working, right? That's what you're supposed to do if someone gets sick, as they did.
Absolutely. That's exactly it. It shows that the clinical trials are working. When you see an event, obviously you have to stop and try to figure out what's causing it and make sense of it. And hopefully we'll hear some more information about what happened.
Dr. Jennifer Nuzzo of Johns Hopkins COVID-19 Testing Insights Initiative, thank you.
Thanks so much.
Jimmy O. Yang is a stand-up comic who starred in the TV show Silicon Valley and the movie Crazy Rich Asians. In his new film, The Opening Act, Jimmy O. Yang plays Will Chu, a cubicle dweller at an insurance company whose dream is to become a stand-up comedian. But without some paying gigs, no one will take him seriously. Then one day, a friend and fellow comedian offers him the opportunity to open at a Pennsylvania improv, and Will hesitates.
Well, I got all these claims that I gotta file.
Chip Fontaine is a made man. He's the manager, and he books not only the Pennsylvania Improv, but 12 more clubs. He's also a Chatty Cathy, and word will get out to all the other clubs. It's just like figure skating. It's a small world.
Figure skating?
Will chucks insurance to follow his dream, but what follows will make him wonder if he's ready to be a comic. The opening act opens in theaters, on digital, and on demand this Friday. And joining me now is Jimmy O. Yang. Welcome to Here and Now.
Hello.
Hello.
Your voice is so soothing. I feel like my voice is probably very jarring to your audience.
No. We should start by saying that, of course, you're much further along in your career than Will. Right. Your comedy special, Good Deal, is on Amazon Prime. But what was it like to play someone at the beginning of his career? And how much of you is Will?
I would say, you know what? I actually did some of my old jokes in the old, beginning act one of like the open mics and stuff like that. It was really interesting. It's almost like semi-autobiographical, semi-documentary, because I think every comic can relate to this. It's just such a real look of the behind the curtains of your first opening gig. And it's interesting. The hardest part, not to toot my own horn here, but the hardest part to do is pretend that I'm bombing, acting like I'm bombing in the movie. It's a very cringy feeling, and we actually want the audience to feel that low as well as the high. It's like a roller coaster ride of what it's really like to be a stand-up comedian.
This is really, as you said, the story of neophyte comedians. There's actually this scene when your character and Chris, another comic on the bill at the Improv, are invited on a local radio show. Chris kills it with a bit about Florida Man, and then Will has to follow him. Let's listen.
Did you guys know that Ponce de Leon discovered Florida? So he was looking for the Fountain of Youth. And I don't know if you guys have been to Florida lately, but it's definitely not in Florida.
They whipped out the cricket sound for that.
Man, they do that. And I mean, those moments are so uncomfortable. And as somebody that has a lot more experience than Will, right? I almost don't want to feel that feeling, because I fought for 12 years in the stand-up comedy clubs doing open mics to know that my jokes will land, to know the good timing, And even if it doesn't, I know a way to roll out of it. But Will doesn't have that skill yet. So I have to just sit in that uncomfortable anxiety. And it's kind of funny.
Yeah, it was for sure. There's this really sweet beginning to this film where we see your character, Will, and his dad throughout his childhood bonding over their love of comedy. What got you into comedy?
I would say that part is definitely not based on my life because dad didn't even know what stand-up comedy was. He still refuses to believe that I'm a stand-up comedian.
Really?
He probably wishes I'm in science or something, finance, a doctor. Yeah.
Have you bought a home yet? That's when he'll really believe it. When you buy a home
He's good now. He's pretty good now. He's all right. He's all right with it. You know, he doesn't understand stand-up. He understands money. So it's all good.
Yeah.
But, I grew up in Hong Kong and I lived there for 13 years and I never seen stand-up comedy growing up. But when I moved to the States, that's when I first started seeing stand-up, where it's a George Lopez special, Dave Chappelle, comedy premium blend. But something that I really loved was BET Comic View. It was just so cool and different to me. Just the art form was different. I'd never seen stand-up. Yeah. And also, you know, mostly Black comedians on there talking about cultural differences and stuff like that. And here, I just came from Hong Kong. All I knew was Hong Kong Chinese culture, you know? So it's so cool to even kind of learn about culture and laugh about it at the same time by watching BET Comic View. So that was something that planted a seed in the back of my mind.
Oh, I loved BET Comic View. That was my jam when I was young. Were you funny, though, as a kid, even when you were in Hong Kong? Were you like a jokester?
I was decently funny. My dad was the funny one. He's always the jokester in the family. And then when I came to America, I was a small kid. I mean, I'm still a small kid, you know, so you can only imagine 13-year-old Jimmy, probably like 4'6", you know, a tiny little kid with a baby face that couldn't even speak English very well. So obviously I couldn't fight, you know, and I had to kind of use comedy to deflect a lot of I wouldn't say bullying because I don't think I got like really, really bullied compared to the people that really got bullied out there. But just the teasing and stuff like that. And then I used, you know, comedy to deflect it. And I became known as kind of like the funny kid. And that was much better than being known as the weird foreign kid.
Mm. There's one joke in the film where Will jokes about being Chinese, but it's not central to this plot. It makes me wonder, in this moment of racial reckoning, as we talk more about representation in Hollywood, do you ever feel the pressure to represent?
Absolutely. All the time. I wish I don't. I don't think Brad Pitt shows up and think about how he's representing white people, because there's enough white people out there. And we're working towards that. I think Crazy Rich Asians did a whole lot. And now all of my castmates from that are all very successful, doing our own thing. And I'm just so happy to see that, you know. And to the credit of Steve Byrne, who directed and wrote this, and Vince Vaughn and Peter Billingsley, who produced this, they casted me for the lead role here. And it wasn't written to be Asian. I think the original name of Will Chu was Will O'Brien in the script.
Really?
Yeah. And that's kind of the great thing about stand-up comedy. Sure, I do some material based on my family about being Asian and stuff like that. But it didn't hinder my career to be Asian or made it different. It's almost like if you feel like you don't fit in, you know, with the norm, stand-up comedy is where you fit in even more. Because that just makes you funnier with more life experience and gives you more depth. So it speaks volume that they are able to hire an Asian person and doesn't really have to change a script at all. You know, it's just a story about stand-up and it just happens to be an Asian person. And I think that's important for representation as well.
Will idolizes a fictional comedian called Billy G, who is played by Cedric the Entertainer. And Billy G has a successful television show, a book. Your character, Will, holds him in awe, even asks him to lunch, and Billy G messes with him for a while. Let's listen.
Do you have any advice for like a young comic? Like, what should I be doing?
I'm gonna tell you two things. Write down.
Okay.
Be funny.
Funny.
I love that scene too. Cedric the Entertainer is also, of course, in the original Kings of Comedy, directed by Spike Lee. What was it like to work with him? And did you all develop a mentorship type relationship in real life?
Oh, absolutely. I'm a huge fan of his. I have that DVD, the original Kings of Comedy, and I watched it many, many, many times. I know every single bit in that. you know, when he said be funny, my character actually wrote down be funny. I think if Cedric said that to me in real life, I would write it down and then ask him to autograph it. You know what I mean? Like I would have done the same thing. And yeah, it was just so great. I think that's the great thing about stand-up comedy. You can start from nothing, from doing open mics to now I'm literally working with my heroes and I can call Cedric a colleague. And it's just something kind of nice about that.
Yeah. You mentioned earlier that this film really is for stand-up comics. Like anyone who's a stand-up comic would understand. But it was also like really fascinating as someone who's not in this world to feel like I kind of stepped into it. Many of the actors in the film are stand-up comics. Did that impact the energy of the film? I'm just wondering about on set. Were you guys just like cracking jokes with each other nonstop?
I mean, I think the chemistry shows through. We're just having so much fun, you know. Some of us are playing comics, like me, Cedric, Whitney Cummings plays a comic in there, Alex Moffat. But then you got Bill Burr, who's an amazing comedian who plays my boss in the movie, you know. Mm-hmm. But you can just tell, like, we know each other's rhythms, you know. And it's also a testament to how good of actors comedians could be. Bill, who has a very successful acting career now, he's just so good, such a professional actor, let alone a comedian, right? So maybe this is a resume to send to other directors and be like, hey, hire more comedians. We can do our thing, you know?
You can do your thing for sure. Well, we have to ask you, watching the opening act, it actually reminded us of what it's like to be in a room with a crowd watching a comic on stage, something that we can't really do because of the pandemic. Yeah. Do you miss it?
I do. I'm starting to more and more. I was lucky. I finished touring and shot my special in November last year. So I was already in a material rebuilding phase. Because once you put the special out, you got to rebuild. You know what I mean? And test out new stuff and things like that. The one thing I do miss the most, which kind of goes back to your last question, is the camaraderie, the green room hang. You know, I know I can show up at the improv, the comedy store, at the Laugh Factory on any given day, and five of my good friends will be there and we'll catch up and have a beer, you know? So that I do miss a lot. The comedy itself, I have been able to shift that energy into writing some screenplays, you know? So I'm finding other creative outlets. But yeah, there's just nothing like a live crowd, you know, and that reaction, that high that you get off of it.
Jimmy O. Yang is the star of the new film, The Opening Act. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And we've been following the ups and downs of small businesses since the pandemic began. It's often more downs than ups. Businesses closing, reopening, in some cases closing again, trying to find the pivot that will keep the lights on. Well, a new survey from the National Federation of Independent Business finds that business owners are feeling more confident about future sales and growth. Let's bring in Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Hello, Robin with an E.
Hello, Robin with an I.
This is called the Optimism Index, and it does look better after dropping to its lowest point in 7 years back in April. What's driving that optimism?
I got to tell you, I think I'm done trying to figure out 2020. Because if you think back to the spring, there were real worries of a full-blown 1930s-like economic collapse, unemployment in the high teens. It seems like, if you look at this report, we've averted the worst of the nightmare scenarios. The Fed and Treasury backstop the economy. We've talked about paycheck protection quite a bit, and housing and residential construction are on fire. And so you're seeing sales for many businesses at least stabilize, and that's being reflected in the optimism numbers.
Yeah, the growth is in 9 of 10 sectors. Can you, by the way, tell us which?
Yeah, I think this index, you know, on the downside, it's been criticized for understating the broader service sector, you know, restaurants, retail shops, hotel workers. And I think that's the weak spot in the survey. There's still a tremendous amount of pain and worry if you look at restaurants with their ability to survive what's being called the carryout normal. There's still hospitality towns. You saw Disneyland's news last week, the movie theater industry. All these players are in cash flow preservation mode. On the flip side of it, manufacturing has rebounded. Businesses with access to capital are reporting here that they're buying equipment and selling off inventory. But I think the takeaway is that the relief is not uniform. So much of this is going to come down to a vaccine and reopening and how much spending you're going to see cycled into that reopening.
Yeah, and maybe what money they get from the government, you know, to help them going forward. But is this the improvement where it is? Is it because people are walking into a physical store, or is it online? What's happening?
Brick and mortar is recovering hesitatingly, and with a lot of regional variation. Online, we know, is on fire. You can look externally at platforms like Amazon's third-party sellers, Shopify in Canada. They're provisioning a broad switch to online for all sorts of small businesses. But there's still tremendous anxiety over right-sizing the right square footage and customer-facing staff if you're a shop owner when online is becoming a bigger part of the sales pie. And to say nothing of working from home for medium-sized businesses that are doubting how much they're paying in rent.
So optimism in some quarters, but is there some, you know, clouds? Are there some clouds you see in this report?
I mean, yeah, of course. If you look around, you have to look for it. What, with 25 million people on unemployment, there's 21% of owners in this report surveyed said that finding qualified labor is their top business problem. 30% in construction report finding qualified labor is their top issue, and maybe the worry of slowing new home production. So you're seeing lumpiness both in the pessimism and the optimism. But you have to step back and conclude that on balance, this is a time of great uncertainty for all businesses. Many are just hanging on, the small businesses. Many are hoping.
Yeah.
And we have election ahead. So, you know, yes, you do have to climb a wall of worry and optimism. Hopefully spring's eternal, but take it with a grain of salt.
Well, I love when you talk finance and the economy, Robin Farzad. Lumpiness will be the new word that we take from
and
this.
Metaphors Robin- galore for you, mixed.
Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure, thank you.
My pleasure.
It's here.
The Department of Justice is expected to announce a lawsuit against Google as soon as this week, and what's anticipated to be the biggest antitrust action since the 1990s case against Microsoft. Calls to rein in big tech have grown louder on Capitol Hill in recent years. And last week, the House Judiciary Committee released the results of a year-long investigation into the business practices of companies including Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google. The report found all four of those companies have monopoly power of some kind, and it laid out a menu of policy options for dealing with tech giants, which the committee likened to the oil barons and railroad tycoons of past eras. And we should mention that Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google all provide financial support to NPR. In a few minutes, we're going to hear from a Democrat on the antitrust subcommittee who says it's time to rewrite the laws. But first, Congressman Ken Buck is a Republican representing Eastern Colorado who says there is another option. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
So you and three of your Republican colleagues on the antitrust subcommittee wrote your own minority report, calling it for a third way ahead. What exactly are you calling for?
Well, first of all, I think most Republicans on the subcommittee and the full Judiciary Committee agree completely with the Democrats that there is a problem. These companies are acting as monopolies. They are crushing competition. They are really cheating and stealing in the marketplace. The solution is really where there is some disagreement. There are four areas that I think we have agreement on. We agree, most importantly, that the Federal Trade Commission and the Antitrust Division at the Department of Justice need more resources. The second area is data portability. Consumers enjoy the ability to take their cell number and go from one cell phone company to another cell phone company. And the same should be true with your search information and other information that you have. The third area is the idea that the burden of proof should change with mergers and acquisitions. The burden should shift to the company to show that the merger acquisition is not anti-competitive. And finally, there is a question about market definition. What is dominant in the market? And the companies at issue here will suggest that they aren't really dominant in the market, and they define the market much more broadly. And so we need to carefully define what it is that we mean when we say dominant in the marketplace.
Okay, so you've laid out four changes that you agree upon. You've supported the repeal of Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act. That's the law that shields internet companies from liability for content posted on their platforms. But is that really addressing the fundamental issues with monopoly power that your committee found exists at these companies?
No, I think that is more designed to address the bias issues that are prevalent with Google, Facebook, Twitter, and some of the others. It basically gives these companies immunity to regulate speech, and that was never what was intended. You know, if you read one newspaper, you'll get a position that is center left, and if you read another newspaper, you get a position that's center right, and nobody objects to that. But they object because Google or Facebook are so dominant in the marketplace. So if we have five Googles, then I don't think the issue of bias is as great.
Congressman, do you think that we will actually see change in the near future? What will change when it comes to the power of these companies?
Well, it depends how you define near future. I think what change we're going to see oftentimes takes years. It will take a couple of years to pass legislative changes to update the laws for this new type of industry in our economy. And then I think it will take close to a decade sometimes to enforce the law through the court system. If you look at the Microsoft case or the AT&T case, years and years of litigation before any result happened. I hope that behavior changes before the litigation is resolved, but that'll be interesting to see.
That's Representative Ken Buck, Republican of Colorado. Congressman, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And now to another view. Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal is a Democrat representing Seattle. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
So this investigation lasted more than a year. You heard from the CEOs of all four companies. Your committee got millions of documents and thousands of hours of interviews, according to the report. What's the main takeaway?
Well, I think the main takeaway is that self-regulation has not worked, and it's come at the expense of small businesses and workers and consumers and ultimately innovation and creativity. So this is really a report that helps make the case for Congress reasserting its power on this issue, on antitrust issues. And so I think we have a number of recommendations, but we're excited to have really a roadmap for the path ahead to rein in anti-competitive behavior, prevent monopolies, and allow innovation to thrive again.
Okay, I want to talk with you about that roadmap, but first, all four companies released statements after your report came out disputing the subcommittee's findings. Apple, for example, says it disagrees that it has a dominant market share in any category that it does business in. And Amazon actually said the presumption that success can only be the result of anti-competitive behavior is simply wrong. These companies are sure to take to court whatever new policies Congress enacts. Do you think anything will fundamentally change as a result of this report?
I do. I mean, I think the report has laid the groundwork for what we need to do. And I think that there is bipartisan sentiment that something needs to be done. It's unfortunate that the companies are taking that stance. This has been 16 months of an investigation with, as you said, lots of documents, lots of briefings, hearings. And you see that the European Commission, for example, has really taken a very different approach. And I think the United States is ready to do the same. And there's a lot of agreement around that on both sides of the aisle that we need to address this anti-competitive behavior.
Your report also found that Google has a monopoly in the general online search and search advertising markets, and that it got this big through anti-competitive tactics like undermining and acquiring rivals. Do you expect any of those concerns to be addressed in the antitrust lawsuit that's expected soon from the Department of Justice?
It's hard to say exactly what the Department of Justice will do, but what we have found in this investigation and talking to the experts is that a lot of our anti-monopoly goals of antitrust law really have not been utilized perfectly by enforcement agencies or seen in the right light by the Supreme Court. And so it's really undermined some of those anti-monopoly goals. And I think what we need to do in Congress is clarify that the harms are broad and not just about price. And that will give the direction. Now, we also need to give resources to the enforcement agencies and change some of the presumptive notions of acquisition. So, for example, the burden of proof would be on them to show that a future acquisition is not going to hurt competition.
Well, Republicans say you just need better enforcement of antitrust rules, not some of these proposals that you're making, not a new playbook, and that you risk major economic damage if you go as far as breaking up big companies. What's your response to that?
Well, first of all, I think, you know, Republicans have been with us on this investigation, and even Ken Buck has talked about, he agrees with 330 of the 400 pages of the report. Yep. So I think that's a great starting place. But I think at the end of the day, you know, the report does not recommend breakup. It does recommend structural separation. This is the idea that if you are a giant platform, you can't set the rules for other competitors that are different than the rules for you to compete, and also operate the platform so that you can get all of the market intelligence and use that leverage in other negotiations to copy, acquire, or kill a competitor. And I think that is a very, very important recommendation. At the end of the day, it affects regular people having choices and small businesses being able to thrive.
So what's next for antitrust? Is there any possibility of new legislation or significant changes to regulations before the next Congress is seated in January?
I think it's unlikely that we'll see a lot of activity before the next Congress, but I certainly think that hopefully within 6 months of the next Congress, we will see some legislation starting to be introduced. Our goal really is to pass legislation in the next Congress. Of course, a lot of it depends on what the Senate looks like and what the White House looks like. But we want to protect small businesses. We want to protect innovation, and we want to protect consumers.
That's Representative Pramila Jayapal, Democrat of Washington State. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tanya.
Let's head to California now, where the state's Republican Party has put more than 50 unauthorized ballot boxes in three counties, labeling them official when they're not. Yesterday, California's Secretary of State Alex Padilla issued a cease and desist to the state's GOP to remove the boxes by Thursday. He says they're breaking state law. The GOP maintains they have the right to collect ballots, but that might be a separate issue from ballot boxes. Rick Hassan is a professor of law and political science at UC Irvine. Professor, what is the law when it comes to who can put out these boxes?
Well, the state is taking the position that these ballot boxes are illegal because, in part, they're misrepresenting that they are official government boxes. And also, you can't set up a polling place on your own without official approval from the government. On the other hand, California has loosened its laws in terms of ballot collection. So anyone is allowed to collect a ballot from anyone else and deliver them to election officials. And so the GOP is relying upon that expansion, which the president and other Republicans have been very critical of, to support setting up these boxes.
Okay, this is ballot harvesting, right? Where you, let's say there are elderly or people who don't want to go to the polls. You say, I will go pick them up for you and bring them in. Can just anybody do that? Or are there any other restrictions on that?
Well, I should first point out that the term ballot harvesting is itself controversial, and that a more neutral term is third-party ballot collection. But you're right. Under California law, it provides that anyone can collect ballots from anyone else and turn them in. It's a crime not to turn them in. There's a place on the ballot return envelope where you're supposed to list who is turning in your ballot, but ballots are going to be counted whether or not that's filled in.
Right. There's supposed to be a signature there, right, on the part of the third party?
Right. There's supposed to be a signature, but the law says the ballot will be counted even if that signature is missing. When you put the ballot in an unofficial ballot box, there's nobody there typically to sign it. So it's going to be in there without that. And then supposedly someone will come later and pick up those ballots and turn them in.
Okay. So backing up to the GOP's boxes, a party spokesperson says they aren't going to remove the boxes, but they will remove the misleading label that has the word official on it. And again, they say what they're doing is collecting. They're using the phrase ballot harvesting. And so, as you say, they're trying to use that part of existing law. But talk about more about what's going on here. If any skeptic thinks that the GOP is trying to get Democratic ballots to be put in a box that, you know, they may then throw away or something, as we said, those ballots are going to be counted. And these boxes are near churches and gun shops in Los Angeles, Fresno, and Orange counties. That's a lot of Republican territory. What is going on here? Why do you think, you know, they might, you know, risk their own party members' ballots?
Yeah, I don't think they're risking the ballots so long as they're going to turn them in. First of all, I think it's very confusing to have unofficial ballot boxes. And unlike the official ballot boxes, which are very tamper-proof and are in locations where they're going to be very hard for third parties to mess with, the reason we wouldn't want to have these out there is because somebody could interfere with the ballots.
It looks like you could just pick it up and throw it in a pickup and take it away.
Well, So I just dropped my ballot the other day into an official ballot box, and it's very sturdy, bolted to the ground, tamper-proof, they're fireproof. But, you know, if you ask why would Republicans do this, I think there's probably two answers. Number one, they're trying to provide a way for their own voters to vote by mail in a way that they might feel more secure if they know that it's the GOP rather than the government that's collecting that or putting in the post office. So one reason is to provide another way of getting those ballots back, because Democrats have a big lead in terms of vote by mail because the president's been saying negative things about vote by mail. But the other thing is, I think it's trying to draw more attention to ballot harvesting or third-party ballot collection in California and the ease with which people can do it. The GOP is saying, well, you know, if union members or workers can go door to door and collect ballots, that's no safer than having this ballot box out there. I don't think that's true because someone else could tamper with that ballot box. But I think it does try to draw attention to that issue.
Are you saying, Professor Hassan, that what we might be seeing here is the GOP realizing that it's Republicans who also want to use these ballots and not go to a polling place during a pandemic, or, you know, they don't trust the mail because the Republican president has been saying don't trust the mail, and they have to do something to try to get a leg up?
Well, you know, just before President Trump started saying negative things about voting by mail, Kevin McCarthy, the leader of Republicans in the House, said that Republicans were going to need to engage in this third-party ballot collection if they were going to try to compete effectively in California. So Republicans are in a tough spot, and not just in California. On the one hand, in places like California, Florida, and elsewhere, Arizona, they've relied very heavily on vote by mail to get out their vote. On the other hand, the president is saying all of this unsupported stuff about people tampering with vote by mail ballots. And so I think they're trying to find a way to thread that needle, but it's a very tough thing to do in this environment.
That's Professor Rick Hassan of UC Irvine with some of his thoughts on the unofficial and potentially illegal GOP ballot boxes in California. Professor, thank you.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.